Okay, it's been a month. Was it this button? No? How about this one? Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 2nd, 2009. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, we begin our coverage of the National Homebrewers Conference in Oakland, California, with a keynote address from Sierra Nevada Brewery founder Ken Grossman. Ken takes us through the history of his brewery and what it was like to start out when breweries his size were rare in the U.S. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook. And if you become a fan of the show there, you'll get occasional notices when shows like this are posted. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. There are also associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. iPhone users, you can now find us on an application called Stitcher. Stitcher is a little application that streams podcast content. So, for example, if it's a Thursday morning and you forgot to download the latest episode of this show, you can stream it. Thanks to the developers of Stitcher for including us in their directory on that application. And I am from Arkansas. While we're on iPhone apps, I got an email from Andrew Kutig from a group called Alpha Acid. So you know it's got to be good. They are developers, and they've developed an application called Adaptunes, which actually varies the volume of your music with your speed. So if you're like driving or like snow skiing or whatever, the faster you go, the louder the volume goes, and you can set how loud through the settings. And when you slow down, it'll get quieter. But the reason I'm mentioning Adaptunes here on this show is that Andrew and his business partner are fans of this podcast. In fact, we've read one of Andrew's letters in the past on the show. And Andrew wrote to me telling me that on the next version of Adaptunes that's out there, they're going to put our logo on the screenshot on the iTunes store. So it looked like they're listening to Basic Brewing Radio there on their screenshot. How cool is that? Very cool. I appreciate that. We had an awesome time in Oakland, Steve and I did, at the National Homebrewers Conference, and we gathered hours and hours of audio and video, and we got to meet a lot of you, which is always a tremendous kick. It's always wonderful to say hi in person and to spend, you know, a couple minutes chatting in person rather than on email and sharing some beers and talking about beers. And, you know, it's always just a kick to get out of the house and see some people that we talk to electronically in person. So I appreciate everybody coming up to us and saying hi. And it was an exhausting time because we were going from sunup till sundown. But it was worth it because we got a lot of content that you will be hearing in the coming weeks. I've gotten a lot of email while we were away, and I appreciate your patience in taking time to get back with you. But I want to get right to this week's content because we are probably going to break a cardinal rule of mine for the first time since July 2005, and that is don't go over an hour. That's a rule that I'm going to be breaking for the next couple weeks as well, because the content itself is an hour long, so me blathering before and after will only add to that. So, but it'll be worth it because it's wonderful, wonderful stuff. I'll be bringing you the two panels at the conference that I moderated, Mead and Troubleshooting. And thanks very much to the AHA and the panel participants for letting me do that. That's coming up in the next couple weeks. And we got other stuff, too, including an excellent interview with Sean Paxton, the homebrew chef, and a decoction experiment with members of WAHA, the Washington State homebrewers, who we spent some time with and had a lot of fun. But that's coming up. Right now, let's get to Ken Grossman's keynote address for the National Homebrewers Conference. Ken showed a lot of great slides, which you will just have to imagine unless they post his presentation on the beertown.org website, which they may very well do. However, the very first voice that you'll hear is that of Charlie Papazian.
All right. Long, long time ago, there were homebrewers who used to make their homebrew, drink a little too much, and then they start dreaming about making their own breweries. Well, it's kind of the same, but different these days, isn't it? In the 1970s, these people that were the pioneer homebrewing people, had homebrew shops, discovering homebrew, did enjoy their beers, and they enjoyed them so much that they figured, wow, my friends like it. I ought to go into the business. But 30 years ago was a lot different than it was today. If you wanted to start a brewery, you'd have to ask yourself, just as you ask yourself today, well, where am I going to get the equipment? You turn to a magazine or go online and figure it out. Plenty of options. Want to get malt? Plenty of options. Want to get hops? Plenty of options. But back in those days, if you wanted to buy malt, the malt people were only used to or accustomed to dealing with train car loads at a time. Bag malt was virtually unknown. Hops and sizes any smaller than a bale was well, you could actually get what they called hops. They came in these pink paper wrappers. They look brown. I never knew what real hops were until mid-80s, I think. You wanted to get yeast, you were relegated to pretty much dried yeast. If you wanted to get a wet culture, you had to pay about $100, $150 for one small culture. If you wanted to get brewing equipment, there were no companies that were custom building, at least in this country, were custom building equipment that were scaled down to the size of breweries that are so common today. So what some of those brewers had to do is figure out what was out there and what they could retrofit. A lot of dairy tanks ended up as some kind of brewing vessel in one way or another. Well, 1978, Ken Grossman, who was involved with a bicycle shop and a home brewing shop in Chico, California, and as a home brewer, probably had a little bit too much of his home brew and decided he wanted to start a brewery. That was in 1978 when he had the idea and really chose to go on the path of opening a brewery. It took him until almost 2 years later until he was able to open it. Things have changed quite a bit. It gives me great pleasure to introduce one of the original pioneers of the microbrewing, craft brewing, home brewing community. You know, he is a brewer, and his brewery is a symbol of what we all dream of or have dreamt of at one time or another. So help me in welcoming Ken Grossman from Chico, California, founder of the Sierra Nevada Brewing Company.
I want to thank all you for being here today. This is such an amazing thing to see 1,000 homebrewers come together. When I started, there was no such thing as homebrew clubs or any of the resources that we have today. And I've spent the last couple months after I was asked to do this talk just thinking about my early days as a homebrewer and how I went from very crude brewing to where I am today. And it's been actually a pretty fun project to go look through my old records, to dredge back old memories that I had of my early days and things I had completely forgotten about for many, many years. So it's been a cathartic experience, and I found some really cool stuff in my records and jogged a bunch of memories. So I thought I'd start out, when I was thinking about this, what a long trip this has been. I mean, it's taken me, I started homebrewing 40 years ago this month is one of the things I realized as I was remembering back to my early days. I started in 1969. And things were way different back then, but as I've thought about what I'm going to say, you know, it was a long, strange trip from my homebrewing days to where we are today. But in the scheme of things, it's really been a short trip. The industries or the history of brewing is 8,000 years old or so. So in 30 years, so much has changed that it's an amazing thing. I have a friend who tracks the brewing industry and has tracked the craft brewing industry from its inception. And he's a financial guy, and he commented to me how he felt that the brewing industry was the craft industry anyway, but I would say the whole brewing industry was really running on dog years. They were so much faster. Things were happening at such a quick pace. And now the last few years anyway with what's happened in the industry, I'd say it's on fruit fly years. The evolution of what's happened just in my short time in the brewing industry has been just totally revolutionary with all the consolidation and changes in the industry. So I'm going to go back a little bit through my history and the history of the craft movement and hopefully have some fun stories for you. Back when I started, I wasn't quite this primitive when I started brewing, but, you know, home brewing was really a fairly primitive thing for most people. You know, during Prohibition, there was obviously a lot of beer that was made with not the best ingredients and not the best methods or technology. Today, and I throughout this talk, I've actually got a lot of pictures I took off the web of you guys from blogs and from homebrew club sites, so you may see yourself out there. I don't know whose pictures I picked up, but I have quite a few of them. This guy with the Bigfoot T-shirt, I thought, deserved to be in here. So, back when I started, Pabst Blue Ribbon, or actually Blue Ribbon, it really wasn't affiliated with the Pabst Brewery in the early days. Blue Ribbon malt syrup was really the standard for home brewing. It was available at my local hardware store, at the grocery store. It was something that was, out there to make inexpensive beer with lots of sugar. Not the ideal brewing base, but it was readily available, and most people home brewed. That's what they used. Here's a homebrew ad or a homebrew shop ad from Prohibition time. So even though brewing was illegal, and it was when I started as well, they didn't make any bones about advertising malt and hops. And you can see in the ad there were Anheuser-Busch or Budweiser malt syrup was one of the things that was available. And many breweries during Prohibition survived by making malt extract and by trying to find other uses, and malt was used in bread baking and other foodstuffs. But I think most of it probably ended up in homebrew at the time. They try to legitimize it, I think, or again, at least find other markets. And, Blue Ribbon malt extract, and some of it was hopped, and you wonder, hopped malt extract for bread baking. And Charlie actually took some of the thunder out of my talk today, because I brought one of these packs, and this was not the kind of pack that I used to get. I used to get a small block, but I was going to ask if anybody out there's used this, and if they actually know what most of these hops, what their use is. And it's actually in bread baking, and the hops that were available to homebrewers back in those days were really processed and packaged for the home or for the bread baking trade in countries like Africa and Sri Lanka and other warm places. They actually used the hops in the starter, and it would help keep the yeast pure and help ward off bacteria in climates where they didn't have refrigeration. So there was quite a bit of that, and I did excerpt. This was out of I'm not going to read it to you, but you can read it up there. They talk about hop cones ground to a fine grayish powder. Well, the hops were gray. They certainly weren't green. And Bud Hollingberry, who owns this company today, and Bud's a great guy, and I don't want to diminish what his business does. He sells hops, and a lot of them do go to third world countries right now for use in bread baking. But he told me a story once when he had some fresh hops. He would normally use 3-5-year-old hops, hops that really had very little brewing value, and he would shred them and press them into these bricks and send them into countries to be used in bread baking. So one year he ran out of old hops and he had to use fresh green hops, and he sent them off, and all his customers started complaining. That's not what they wanted. They smelled. They had all this aroma. And so he took the bales and broke them out in the sun and left them out in the sun for a week, and then he processed them, and the bread bakers were happy with that. Well, that was the quality of hops that we were using in our home brews in the early days, so quite unfortunate. At this point, I think I'm going to say a disclaimer, because I'm sure I'll implicate myself in some illegal activities here from now on. But I did start brewing at a very young age, and I do not advocate breaking the law or underage drinking or home brewing. So just because I did it, I was a little bit of a juvenile delinquent. I wouldn't recommend that any of your kids follow my path. But I did start brewing at a fairly young age, and this ad on the left here, I don't know what year that ran, but that would be pretty unacceptable in today's marketplace. The way I got started home brewing is I had a neighbor, and from when I was about 5 years old, my best buddy down three houses down, his father was a very serious home brewer and home winemaker. And from when I was just a little guy, there would always be fermenters in the hallway. He had a service porch where he had a half a dozen fermenters. He had a bunch of refrigerators. Eventually, he ended up building a big cold box. So he was very much into home brewing and home winemaking. He was actually a scientist. He was a metallurgist to work for Rocketdyne, and did do the metallurgy. The space shuttle was the last project he worked on before he retired. So it is rocket science as far as home brewing. But when I was a little kid, he was always boiling something on the stove. So I remember from very early days, the aromas and the exotic smells coming out of these jugs. And so I think I had home brewing in my blood from a very, very early age. I also remembered fondly, he was a Ballantine's Ale fan, and as the juvenile delinquent I was, we would borrow some of those occasionally to try. And I remember him remarking, how can they sell a beer that's been aged in wood for a year for a dollar more a six-pack than regular conventional beer? And that's about what it was, a dollar more a six-pack for India Pale Ale aged in wood. And it's pretty fitting that today the yeast we use, we think, is a variant of what Ballantine's used. So way back to my youth, I remembered that beer and what it tasted like. It was a very unique beer. I mean, here's a brewery very much ahead of its time. This beer was brewed in 1946 and bottled in 1961 as a gift to give to beer distributors, and it had been aged in wood all that time. This was what their old fermentation cellar looked like, a lot of open wooden fermenters. And here's a great shot of their India Pale Ale aging in wooden barrels. I actually have to confess, I did start out as a winemaker. I remember convincing my mother that I was really into grape juice and having her buy a bunch of grape juice. And I had a couple of gallon jugs going in the closet when I was fairly young. I did realize the error in my ways, though, and I turned into a brewer, and this was, the summer after junior high school, so I was fairly young, but I started with a recipe something like this. I couldn't find my original recipe, but I have a feeling it was no more sophisticated than this. I recall the very first brewing book I found, and this was a book that was available, and back in those days, there wasn't really a lot of there wasn't really any knowledge about home brewing that was from the U.S., at least none I'm aware of or could find at the time. I think this book was written in the early 60s, and it had some ideas on how to do home mashing and using a wine bottle to crack your malted barley or a blender, and I don't think either of those things probably worked very well. I've got some faint recollections of doing some of these mashes, and if you look at the very bottom there, he shows using a 50-watt immersion heater. And I remember taking the fish tank heater out of our aquarium and monkeying with the thermostat so I could get it up to 150 degrees and doing these all-night mashes with the fish tank aquarium heater. Did not produce very satisfactory results. So there was not a lot of knowledge about how to make all-grain beer back in the early 60s. Fred Eckhart, who I stayed in touch with for many years, he came out with this book, I think, around 1970. And it was really the first sort of a glimpse at lager brewing styles, and he had a whole bunch of recipes. I recall the first edition was pretty poorly organized, but it did inspire me, and it talked about things like dry hopping and some other concepts that were fairly new to me at the time. So I started brewing a lot of Fred's recipes and learned quite a bit about better home brewing techniques. This is the inside cover of that book. There was a group, Weinart, who I think started in the late 50s, early 60s, and they were supplying homebrew shops and had affiliated with a bunch of homebrew shops. And there's probably somebody in here from a homebrew shop who has got more background than I do on Weinart. But this is what I would say was probably the first wave of some quality ingredients coming into the homebrew trade. And there was some hops that were coming in that were better and yeasts and other things that that made home brewing a little bit better. But as you can see, they're called Weinart because back then, again, brewing was illegal in the United States. When this book came out in, I think this was in 72, this was really an eye-opener for me. It had a lot of information, talked about enzymes and pH, and now all those chemistry and science classes I was taking in high school made some more sense. And it really taught me that you could make good beer, and the techniques he had were still fairly simple, using an igloo jug and doing things still on a fairly simple scale, but at least there was some reasonable science behind why you were doing what you were doing. I moved to Chico in 1972, and there were no homebrew shops up in Chico. There was a drugstore that carried blue ribbon malt extract and those red packages of hops, but there was no homebrew shop there, so I actually started malting my own grain back in the early 70s and did it in a bucket, and I had the ability to make mediocre malt, but it did work. I was making wheat malt. I'd go to the co-op and buy wheat and malt that and roasting my own grains. Again, there was not a good source of grains. And I had this dream of making a little malt house out of a washer-dryer combo. And so I purchased a washer-dryer and started to try to turn it into a little malt house. I mean, it does all you need. It wets the laundry, and then it dries it, and that's what malt needs to sprout and dry. I never completed that project, and after seeing some of your guys' innovations, I bet by next year one of you will have converted a washer-dryer into a malt house. This was something that I just dredged up out of my brain actually two nights ago. I read Mad Magazine when I was in my youth. My next door neighbor was a little older than me, and he had a subscription. This stuck in my mind, and I dredged it up about, I remember this Maytag still ad, and I don't know if this inspired Fritz to get into the distillation business or not, but I realized when I looked this up, I was 10 years old when I saw this ad, so it left a pretty long impression. My neighbor convinced me to open a homebrew shop in the mid-70s. I'd been homebrewing, and you get a lot of friends when you homebrew, and not having the ability to buy good ingredients, he convinced me that there was a market for it. So he loaned me some money, and the two of us opened up a little homebrew shop, which I ended up, after a few months, he was bored, so I bought him out. And my wife and I ran this for several years. I paid $57 a month rent, and actually I was the janitor for the building in lieu of rent, so I had free rent, and a good day for us was about $40 worth of sales. We struggled along for a few years, and I put this shot up. This is early Maltose Falcons. There's probably some Maltose Falcons here, I would assume, but John in back there, John Dom, who's the owner of the home wine shop down in Southern California. I left before the Maltose Falcons started up, but my brother was a member and my ex-partner was a member. But John helped me along quite a bit and sold me supplies and let me buy in with him on the home brewing equipment and supplies for my shop. So he was very helpful in my early days. I actually attended my first homebrew conference here in Oakland 31 years ago, and it was a conference intended for the supply side more so than the consumer or the homebrewers. But right about that time, the bill was passed to legalize homebrewing, so homebrewing sort of came out of the closet, and that group changed its name and added beer to the name rather than just being a wine shop. But what ended up happening on that trip, I went over to the Anchor Brewery and met Fritz Maytag. I took a tour of the brewery at this is the old facility, and bought a case of Old Foghorn from him. And I was incredibly inspired, and I saw what he was doing on a small scale. And I didn't think I could do that, but it really started to get me thinking about opening a brewery. I then made a pilgrimage over to New Albion and met with Jack McAuliffe, and He was an incredibly creative and a very interesting character. Actually, I just spoke with him this week, and one of the things that has been fun with this project of thinking about this is I've contacted many of the old early pioneers who are still around. But Jack was in a pretty terrible automobile accident several months ago, and he's just getting out of the hospital this week. And hopefully he'll be able to get back to his strength and be able to go on with his life. But he was pretty severely injured in that accident. But back in the 70s, he was truly a pioneer. He built everything himself. This was his malt mill, and I'd say I made several visits down and talked with him. And when I returned after my second visit, I said, "That's it. I'm selling my homebrew shop, and I'm going to open a brewery." And he gave me some very sound advice on numerous things, but a couple ones that still stick in my mind is the brewery is a strict mistress, and it's proven to be that way all these years. The other thing he said is you got to bring lots of money. He was struggling under being severely undercapitalized, and he struggled his whole existence there. As he was growing his business and making good beer, he was truly at a point where he just didn't have enough cash flow to survive. But he showed, I think, all of us and a whole generation of brewers after him how you could put things together. You didn't need to be buying equipment from manufacturers, and there weren't any manufacturers in the U.S., as Charlie had mentioned. We certainly couldn't have financed buying equipment over in Germany or England, where you might have been able to find it. But this was Jack's original little brewery. He built everything. So this was his Bottolo cooler, and it was made out of copper tubing with little copper fins that he soldered on individually. I mean, it was a truly handmade cooler. His mash tun. His fermenters were fairly simple. He had a barrel and a half brew length, and he was using 55-gallon stainless steel barrels to brew in. Pretty low tech. He spent about $35,000 to build his brewery and to get the doors open, which you know back then was a fair amount of money for such a risky venture. His bottling line, which was, again, a 55-gallon barrel. It was a gravity filler. He did all bottle conditioning. His refrigeration plant, again, he built it himself. He was a merchant marine and had quite a bit of hands-on experience doing fabrication and construction. So when I saw all this stuff, I realized I didn't have to buy any of this equipment. I could make it and we could piece together a brewery ourselves. So when I got back to Chico, I started writing a business plan. And New Albany at that point was starting to make some money, and we looked at Anchor and New Albion, and there were a couple of the little breweries that were in the startup phase, and we all talked. It was such a small community back then. Jack did a bunch of things right, and one of the things he did was he had a laboratory, and he knew the importance of having good microbiological controls, and even though he didn't have a lot of sophisticated equipment, he did know how to plate, he knew how to culture his yeast, and it was a challenge for him. I mean, his brewery did have some areas that were pretty tough to maintain, and that open cooler with copper fin tubing on it was certainly a nightmare, I'm sure, to keep clean. But he did pay attention to the right things, and he really had a path for, I think, all the rest of us to follow. So New Albion was showing a profit, and that was enough to encourage, I think, a few of us to start looking at getting into the business. So here's a cover in my financial analysis of my business plan. I dredged this up fairly recently. And I saw Jack had, he told me he'd spent $35,000, and we realized that his volume of a barrel and a half was really not a viable size to have a business that could afford to pay the employees or pay ourselves. So we were going to do 10 barrels. That was what we decided was the size we'd start with. And I thought I could do it for $50,000, so that was in my original business plan. At this point, I see I'd already spent $22,000, and I was trying to raise another $50,000, and we eventually ended up spending all that money after we raised the money with our families and friends. We went to a bunch of banks, and nobody would give us a penny. We ended up running out of money numerous times over the last few months and kept going back to our family and friends and asking for another couple thousand, a few more thousand after that. We eventually spent about $100,000 to get the doors open. I have this shot in here because people wonder where the name Sierra Nevada came from. And besides being a bit of a juvenile delinquent, I was also a climber. And so I spent quite a bit of my time in the Sierras, backpacking and mountaineering. And my daughter was named Sierra before I opened the brewery for my love of the mountains. So that's where the name came from originally. We were very fortunate to have UC Davis just down the road, and Dr. Michael Lewis, who's here today, was also a great asset to us, and some of his grad students were advising us on what we should think about when we were trying to open this budget brewery. But what we really found as a great resource was their library. So I spent hundreds of quarters, and we photostatted just about every one of the periodicals and magazines they had. We bought the few brewing books that were on the market for commercial brewers, Malting and Brewing Science and Practical Brewer and other things like that. But all of these articles we photostatted off became a real learning tool for us. And we had our own Dewey Decimal System here. We had ratings. So this is a 3-star article. And I would go back and read the 3-star article several times, and the 2 stars maybe once again. But it really helped build our knowledge of brewing. And, you know, our technology level was probably closer to a 1940s or 50s brewery. You know, we didn't have pressurized fermenters, and we were bottle conditioning, and we had, you know, a fair amount of low technology kinds of things we did. But we did know about hygiene, and I think having the background of all these articles on proper brewing science certainly helped us along. I've got, this is my first pale ale recipe, that pale ale number one that we were homebrewing. And those of you who are trying to copy it, it's like my mother's brownie recipe. I left out some vital ingredient there. So, so we actually made dozens of pale ale brews, different yeast strains and different hopping rates and different water salting and different water chemistry adjustments with pH and all sorts of things. So every week as we were building the brewery, we were brewing a batch of homebrew, and we were checking out a different yeast strain and a different way of doing it. And we thought we had it. This goes to pale ale number 6. I have several more pages of these as we experimented along. I'm going to show you, this is our yeast collection. And back in those days, there weren't any yeast laboratories that were selling slants to homebrewers. And there were some commercial laboratories. But we were fairly progressive homebrewers, and we had our own yeast laboratory. And you see Anheuser-Busch lager. So I'll tell you a little story about that. We had a friend, and I won't mention names. I think he's passed away, so I guess it doesn't matter. But he worked at this large brewery in Southern California, and he was a friend of my buddy Cal. And so every once in a while, a thermos full of yeast would come home in his lunchbox with some great hops that had names of from countries I never even heard of at the time. So I knew there were better homebrewing ingredients than these red bricks of hops. So we were aware there was a big world out there, and we actually developed our own little yeast collection and played with these strains as well as others later on. This is a transfer, so every 6 months we would reslant all of our strains, so I'm not sure some of these we got in the mid-70s. Another brewery opened up after Jack down in the Bay Area here, DeBacher Brewing, and I went down and visited Tom. And he was a firefighter, again, an avid home brewer who went pro. And there was, again, a handful of us that were either in the process of opening breweries or at some phase, and we all pretty much knew each other, and we'd talk on the phone. It was a pretty tight-knit community. There were, I think, about 6 of us who started around that time. This is the Boulder Brewery in Colorado, and they, I think, started building after us, but their building was an old goat barn, so they had a little bit of a jump on us as far as the facility. We built all ours from scratch pretty much. So they got to market a little bit ahead of us. They also opened in 1980. And this is a shot with Michael Jackson and Alan Dickey, and they were on a brewery tour. And they actually made several tours out to our brewery as well. We were on such a shoestring that we did all the construction ourselves. So I'm there behind the tank, and that's my partner Paul up on the roof. We did all the framing. I did all the electrical. I did all the plumbing. I did all the welding. I enrolled in the junior college and took refrigeration classes and welding classes and actually enrolled in every agricultural class that had the ability to use the shop so I could build my equipment out there. So I had a very understanding professor, and I could use their forklifts and drill presses and welders and things that I didn't have. So I had five sessions of agricultural mechanics and whatever else. But Boulder got to the market before us, and they were starting to take off, and they were doing well, and we were getting frustrated, and we were having to build all the stuff because we couldn't afford to buy it. And I show this shot because at the very end, I was totally out of money, and I couldn't afford to buy perforated false bottom plates. So I spent 2 days drilling, I estimate, 4,000 holes in the bottom of this false bottom just to get us so we could start our first brew. So we finally got to a point of getting our brewing license, and we were off and running, we thought. And that's what the brewery looked like when we got it done. I showed this shot. This was my delivery truck. That's my daughter, Sierra, when she was about three, I think. I used to drive this down to pick up malt at a maltster here in San Francisco called Bauer Schweitzer Malting. And I tell the story the first time I had these two bins on the back, and I drove under the big chute at Bauer Schweitzer. And again, they were used to filling rail cars and trucks. And at that point, they were only supplying us an Anchor, I think, locally, and a little bit to New Albion. They were on their last legs. It's now a condominium down by Fisherman's Wharf. But I drove my 57 Chevy down there and with these two bins in the back, and I told them to fill it up. And I drove over the scale and realized my one-ton truck, I had 10,200 pounds. I told them I had to take one of the bins off and take it back, and they said, no, it's yours. We're not taking any of that malt back. So I drove at 40 miles an hour back up to Chico as fast as it would go, swerving all over the road. I was so overloaded. I did get pulled over, actually, in Yuba City, and I was able to talk the policeman out of the ticket, thankfully. He didn't have a scale, so he had no idea how overloaded I was. But this was also my delivery truck, and I took my first pallet of beer down to the Bay Area in this truck. And in hindsight, I can understand why they laughed at me. You know, they're used to a nice Coors truck that's all shiny pulling up, and here's a 57 Chevy with the bed made out of scrap 2x4s. I'd gotten them all behind the lumber yard. Little short 2 or 3 foot sections cobbled together, and I had this one pallet of beer, no six packs. We couldn't afford those in the early days. And when I drove up, they literally were all just like pointing and laughing at me. And now I know why. So we finally brewed the first batch of beer, 5 barrels of stout. I found this shot, or a friend of mine sent it to me. I think this was the very first brew back in November 15th of 1980. There's my records. So this was stout number one, and we used that just to get the equipment sort of figured out. And then we started brewing pale ale number one based on our recipe that we had homebrewed. And the first brew came out sort of okay, and the second brew was a little sluggish fermentation, and third brew was okay, and we were thinking we were on track. And I remember pale ale number three being one I was pretty proud to show and give to my friends. We weren't quite ready to go to market. And then number four wasn't quite so good, and five wasn't quite so good, and we sort of said, oh, what's going on here? We were having some fermentation issues. Sort of struggled through that and dumped the first 12 brews, decided that we weren't ready to go to market yet because we hadn't figured out how to make the same beer batch after batch, and it was an extremely painful process when we were so broke and we really needed to get to market. But we had the sense at that point that until we could figure out how to make the beer the same day after day, we weren't going to start selling any. At that point, some of our peers who had maybe started a year or two ahead of us were starting to suffer from some quality issues, and there was starting to be a little bit of a challenge from the consumer about, well, the beer didn't taste the same this time as it did last time. So we were pretty focused on quality. This was what my fermentation cellar looked like, 2 10-barrel dairy tanks and an open Bottle-O cooler. That was all we had for fermentation, and I had six little storage tanks, 10 barrels, that I had welded myself, and these were atmospheric tanks, so we had a bottle condition. That was, you know, part of our limitation of finances. We just couldn't afford to have lager capabilities or filtering or carbonating capabilities, so we chose to go down the bottle condition path, and we're still doing that today. I found these letters I completely forgot about. We started writing breweries when we were starting to have some issues. So here's a letter back from Peter Austin and Ringwood and Cooper's, who was doing a bottle-conditioned beer. And we found out after checking everything, and since I'd worked in a chem lab, I was utilizing their spectrophotometers and looking for calcium levels and all these things we thought were our fermentation problems. Turned out we didn't have enough oxygen, and as I had mentioned, the yeast that we're using currently, we think was a variant of what Ballantine's used. We actually called a Ballantine's brewer back then, and he said, you just need to give it a lot of oxygen. And we just assumed with that open cooler and the wort splashing down that we were aerating our wort adequately. It turned out that was our only problem, and I just I took this pipe as it went into the fermenter, and I squeezed it into a fishtail spray, and we sprayed the wort in. And from then on, our problems were all solved, and we were off and running. We had consistent fermentations batch after batch. So we finally got on the market early in 81, and here we said we were brewing all we could. Of course, 25 barrels a week isn't a lot of beer, but we were at full capacity for that little two open fermenter cellar. And this is a snapshot of what the marketplace looked like in 1981. And this was all the small brewers under 1 million barrels. And there was about six of us that were new brewers, and all the rest were old family regional breweries who, in most cases, were struggling to stay in existence. This was pretty much a low point of the U.S. brewing industry. Sadly, less than 15 of these breweries, actually less than 15 breweries that were in business in 1980 are still in existence today. So out of the 1,500 breweries that are now in America, only 15 have been around since before 1980. So pretty surprising. Anchor was doing great. Fritz was doing a great job expanding around the country and sort of leading the way with pricing, showing that American beer could command a premium price and could compete with the imported beers. And so he really set a great bar for us on pricing. And you know, he realized that in order to survive as a little brewery, you had to charge a premium price and you had to make a unique product. We also realized that quality was going to be, you know, hugely important for our success. And so we built a lab, and most of the small brewers back in those days, even the old regional brewers, didn't have any laboratory facilities. They were either relying on an outside lab or just didn't pay attention to that. And that's part of why they, I think, ceased to exist after a few years. But we had a little laboratory, very low-tech, but we knew how to plate our yeast, and we knew how to look for oxygen in the headspace of our bottles and things like that. So we were paying attention to what we thought was important with the amount of limited funds we had. Today we've got several laboratories. This is our R&D laboratory, so we've still kept the philosophy that we need to focus on quality and improving what we do day in and day out. So we've invested heavily in research and in laboratory facilities. We've got three gas chromatographs, and this is one with an olfactory port where you can actually smell the compound as you're analyzing it. So if you've got a flavor you love or you hate, you can hopefully find out what it is and figure out where it came from. It's from hops or fermentation or whatever. We also have been involved in doing a bit of research. We've spent a lot of effort studying bottle cap lining materials, and you know, bottle cap needs to keep CO2 in, but most people probably don't realize a lot of oxygen leaks in, even though the bottle's under pressure. And also the lining material scalps or absorbs a lot of aroma compounds. So we've been on a real quest to find the perfect liner material that both blocks oxygen as well as doesn't scalp aroma compounds. This was my entire staff, but my quality control team as well. And this was our hospitality space as well. This is where we would show our tours. They would sit and have beer with us. Today we have two full-time sensory people, and we pay a lot of attention to sensory, even though we've got a lot of fancy equipment. How the beer tastes and smells day in and day out is very critical. So you have to rely on the human nose and flavor, really, to make sure that you're on the right track always. Cartwright Brewery, another small brewery that's long since gone up in Portland, and he sort of broke into the supermarket trade and really showed that, you know, craft beers, even back in those days, could be sold in a supermarket. We were expanding and growing, and we expanded out of Chico and into the Bay Area first, and then we started, as we would add a little capacity here or there, we'd start selling some beer in other parts of the country. So I put a grist case, is why I show this one. I used to lug the tubs of malt up. I'd grind them into a bucket and dump them in and use a canoe paddle. So it was high-tech here with a grist case. We added two more fermenters, so I had four of these open fermenters, four 10-barrel tanks going. We were making all the beer we could. We finally got rid of those 10s and put in some 35-barrel tanks. These are the first new tanks I bought in the early 80s. These were JB Northwestern. I liked the square concept just because it was what I saw in England at some breweries, so I thought that was cool. So we went with square fermenters, even though they were hard to build. And we still use open fermenters today. This is Keller Weiss from just a few months ago, in open fermentation. We do have a lot of closed tanks, and most of our fermenters are closed fermenters, but I still love watching beer ferment and the smell. So I got a little video here. Some of you might have seen this Bigfoot video, but I think it's pretty cool, so we'll show it.
Now, what you're not seeing here is a video that they shot of the open fermenters at Sierra Nevada. And you see Bigfoot wort going in, being aerated, and then massive fermentation. And in fact, so big that the croizen comes up and flows over the lip of the open fermenters. And then as the fermentation subsides, the croizen, the foam, starts to go back down. And then you see the fermenters drained and then cleaned. The video is available on the Sierra Nevada website on the product page for Bigfoot. And I will also put a link to the video on basicbrewingradio.com in the description of this episode. Now back to Ken.
Bill Manley, the guy who did the video, is right down here, is one of our employees. So thanks, Bill. This was my first bottling line, so this was right when we opened, 50 bottles a minute. It was a soft drink filler that was terrible. Really did a bad job filling beer, but thankfully we had so much yeast in our bottles that we sucked up all the oxygen we got in. It was not a good beer filler, and we quickly replaced it, actually. Thankfully, Fritz needed a new bottle filler, so we bought his old one. Here I am running a 1940s vintage labeler, which was a death machine. At the end of a bottling run, there would be a mound of glass, and I had one of my employees' wives come and work one day, volunteer in the bottling line, and after a shard shot out and cut me in the arm and I needed to run and go get stitches in the middle of bottling day, she said, "This is it. I'm never working here again." Back in those days, all returnable bottles. We were using long neck bar bottles, and I unfortunately don't have a shot of some of the really cool cases, but we bought all the glass float out of some defunct breweries. The Meyer Brewing Company in L.A., I bought truckloads of old bottles, and they had these great labels on them that today are worth hundreds of dollars, and I washed them all off for a nickel a bottle, you know, I was buying them for. And if I would have had the forethought, I would have put all those things in a museum somewhere or storage and funded the whole new brewery with them. But we were using all these old bottles I got from Schlitz or Budweiser, whoever would sell me long-neck bottles at the time. And I'd have to wash them once to get the labels and the gunk out of them, and then wash them a second time when we were actually bottling. So I'd brew 3 days a week and bottle 2 days a week. And back when we started, no six-packs, we couldn't afford those. All these open containers were because we were bottle conditioning, and these bottles were like 30 or 40 years old, some of them. A good percentage would blow up. So we came to waiting a couple weeks and then going back through the cases and seeing how many of them had cracked or broken and then taping them up. I show this door because we were so naive about the beer industry. I never envisioned a forklift, and so this door was wide enough for a hand truck to go in and out. And I never thought I'd be selling a pallet of beer at a time. I mean, I figured, you know, a case here, a case there, but never a pallet. So we knew nothing about selling beer. We just liked to drink it and figured we could make enough to drink and make enough money. This was the filler I bought from Fritz, so... You know, back then, it was a very small community, and as Fritz would cast stuff off, I was waiting in the wings, and this was a true bottle filler for beer. Came out of the Siebens Brewery in Chicago. It was one of Al Capone's breweries, and we did a much better job with this filler and ran it for quite a few years, and this, I think, went about 80 bottles a minute. We didn't filter in the early days, and the malt we were getting out of Bauer Schweitzer malting was actually fairly modified and was a good infusion malt, since we were using it and Anchor was using it and not too many of the breweries. It was pretty fully modified. Once we switched to another malt house, we started having real haze problems and really variable amounts of yeast and other issues. So we started filtering again, another cast off from Anchor. Just another quick shot here. So this is a year later, and a couple of the small breweries have already closed. And now this shows 43 breweries in America. A few more had opened, and I say a couple had closed. The Bacher, I think, is gone by here. Started out with no draft beer. Back in those days, draft beer was somewhat of a loss leader for most breweries. People didn't make a lot of profit off draft, and we realized if we were going to survive, we had to make the maximum profit per barrel, and so we were bottles only for the first several years until the craft and specialty draft market started to expand a little bit. This was an article that was in the San Francisco Chronicle magazine, and it came out, it was on the Sunday edition and sat on people's tables. And this was such a shot in the arm for us, and it happened right about the same time that we had a Chico State student whose father was a buyer for one of the big supermarket chains, and he used to visit his daughter and come by the brewery and drink beer, and he liked us, and so he started running ads all the time for us, which we were quite grateful for, but we couldn't keep up with production, and when this article hit, we were just totally maxed out. So I was back to the drawing board and starting to figure out how to expand, and found a brew house over in Germany in the the early 80s and went over there with a buddy, and we took it out, which was an incredible experience. Moving these big things, I'd never moved anything that big, but we had a couple of Germans working with us who spoke no English, and I spoke no German. So we had a pretty fun 3 weeks dismantling this brewery. Got it back to Chico, and figured we'd find somebody to loan us money, which we didn't. So we searched and searched, and it actually sat there for about almost 4 years while we raised our volume and kept figuring out how to make more and more beer so we could get our cash flow up and have enough of a track record. We could attract some capital. So I added some more tanks. So you can see through the back, I knocked out some holes. That was our old warehouse. Put a couple of 60-barrel tanks in and added another layer of aging tanks. Now I'm going to skip ahead like 20 years. So here's where we are today. I figured I didn't have time to go through the intermediate 20 years, but this is what the plant looks like today. We're on about 15 acres. You can see a lot of our solar panels. We've actually got over 10,000 solar panels installed. We're producing about 90% of our own electricity right now with our solar and our fuel cells. We've got a group of fuel cells as well. And our hop field off there to the left, we've got 9 acres of hops growing at the brewery currently. We had 3 acres, and we planted another 6 acres last year. We're looking like we're going to have a great crop this year. Of course, it's a little too early to tell, but we've got a pretty good crop going. This was a couple years ago harvest, and we've been making our fresh harvest ale, Chico State ale, with those hops. Something we did unique this year, we actually planted a barley field on our property, and we just harvested 26 acres a couple weeks ago, and it's sent off now to get malted. It's looking great, low protein, about 10% protein. So we're hoping we'll have the first estate beer that what we've made with our own malt and hops this year. So that's in the works. I've been asked a lot about Torpedo. It has nothing to do with this. And I'll show you these what the torpedoes look like, so those of you who are curious. This is a project I started working on years ago with not great success, and we finally sort of perfected it. So we use all whole cone hops. We're, the largest user of whole cone hops in the world now, as far as we know. And we pack these things full of about 100 pounds of whole cone hops, and they've got some screens and things in them, and we circulate the beer slowly through a bed of hops for up to about a week or so. So these hook up to our fermenters, and we do that during the aging process. So that's what the torpedo's all about. Just a few quick shots. This is our pilot brewery, so I'm back again with a 10-barrel brew house, which is what I started out originally. And we've got this very state-of-the-art pilot brewery. This is Scott who runs it. And we tried to mimic what we were doing in the bigger brewery. So we've got two kettles, and we've got different kinds of boiling systems and the ability to do a whole bunch of fun stuff on a pilot level. This is what the pilot cellar looks like underneath. And we've been using this for beer camp, so we're doing a lot of training. And we've had quite a few people come and spend a few days learning about beer, learning about brewing, and actually get to brew. And so writers and distributors and other people in the industry who really haven't had hands-on brewing experience, and some who have. So it's a fun thing. As I was spending quite a bit of time looking at what you guys have been doing the last 30 years, I was blown away by some of what I saw both on the websites that some of you have, the club sites. I mean, there's almost 100 brew clubs in California, I found. So I spent hours and hours. I was fascinated to look at the innovations and the passion that the home brewers have for their craft, and such a difference from when I started. I mean, there were no homebrew clubs. There were a limited amount of homebrew shops who knew much about making beer. And actually, I took this off Beer Guru's website, who I don't know, but I thought it was a pretty great statement. Although my only complaint with it is I would get rid of the homebrewing. I think we're all brewers. And having spent the last couple of days here talking to so many of you, you've got the same passions and the same knowledge and understanding of brewing and want to learn more about beer and brewing. It's a fascinating thing. And as I've spent my last 30 years in the industry, one of the things that I found is whether you're an Anheuser-Busch or a Miller or Coors, I can call up those breweries, and I have many, many times over the years, and ask a question and talk to a knowledgeable brewer or talk to a knowledgeable person, and they'll help me out. And they've been so instrumental in our growth as a company and being able to, you know, have the ability to talk with somebody who's got that experience and have them share that. Our salespeople may hate each other, but the brewers across all the industries, and I'm great friends with many small brewers today, and we have a very great and open policy. If somebody ever wants to come and tour my plant and talk to me about something, I've always reciprocated, just because when I was first starting out, I bugged Fritz, and I think back on some of the stuff I did. I'd drop in and want to go look at something and just assume that he would go take me to go look at you know, how he pumps into his fermenter or whatever it was. And they always were so cordial, and even though I'm sure I was a pain, they helped us out along the way, and I said the big brewers has done that to me, and so hopefully we can offer that same kind of connection to you guys and help the process of home brewing and the exchange of knowledge. I spent, say, time scanning what's out there as far as resources and the Homebrew Club listings, and I was just shocked at some of the systems that you guys have built, way more sophisticated than my first brewery, and there's lots of them out there. The forum, you know, 12,000 of you get the forum every day, or more than that, I guess, at this point. And the amount of exchange of information and resources are just fantastic. Here's a Charlie's recipe I found somewhere. But the resources and the knowledge that's been shared is just tremendous. This was somebody's homebrew setup. I have no idea whose it was. I just spotted it on the web. And this is way more sophisticated than my first brewery with the way it's organized and the investment people have made. I'm going to finish on that note, and I think I've got a few minutes to take a couple of questions. So while this plays, and this is shots from you guys, again, I have no idea who's in them or what you guys are doing. You may see yourself, but if there's anybody who's got anything to ask me about beer or brewing or history, I'd be happy to try to answer it. Breeze. Yeah, couldn't batch-wise, we have about 100,000 pounds, and so we sent it back there. I have, and I almost built one a few years ago. Actually, I made a pilgrimage to Scotland and to England with a maltster, and we went and looked at a bunch of maltings and floor maltings and small maltings, and I actually started plans about 5 years ago. I started drawing up a little malt house, and it got put on the back burner for other projects, but I'd love to do it. I think it would be a great thing to do, and obviously we're not going to malt all of our grain, but having our hop field at the brewery allows us to show people what hops look like growing and really allow the customer and the consumers to see that, and I think having a little malting operation would do the same thing on the barley side. We'll talk about that. You know, it's being used today, and they're trying to sell it back to me, so I may get it back at some point. But it's still making beer. It's so ugly, though, that I don't know how I could dress it up. But yeah. Was it really? All right. Sure. Question was our decision to go to Crown Caps. We actually started studying oxygen ingress through crown liners, I think it was around 1989. There was an article written, I think it was a Master Brewers article, about oxygen ingress through crowns, and there was starting to be some research done in that area. And so we started experimenting with oxygen-absorbing crowns, which was the technology that was out or being touted in those days, and found some negative as well as some positive aspects with that. We realized there was some benefit, but you couldn't use them with a twist-off crown. And so we continued to study the pros and cons, and finally we new barrier compound, or fairly new barrier compound, that had great oxygen ingress abilities, much, much better, we thought, than the absorber kind of technology. And so we made the decision after a lot of hard thought, but maybe not enough thought about how some of our customers who were used to twist-offs were going to react, because I got more angry emails off of that than anything else I've done by far. But I think, you know, we've definitely noticed an improvement in beer flavor stability. And it's something that's pretty significant. And when we have a distributor or a consumer that we take the same beer with a twist off and a pry off, and we've done these experiments and let them sit for 4 or 5 months, it's a marked difference in oxidation when you taste the two. So it's night and day. Yes. It's slightly lower in alcohol. The impetus originally was there was a law in California, draft beer had to be lower than, I think it was 5% at the time, and our pale ale was higher than that. So we made a slightly lower alcohol version of it, and they eventually changed that law, but we didn't want to revert back. So our draft has one or two BUs less, like 35 or 6 instead of 36 or 7, and a slightly greater amount of caramel malt and a little lower alcohol. The very first one, it was a challenge because you know we were one of the first. I mean, New Albion was the first, but the TTB or ATF back then was not really used to issuing beer licenses, and so it was a bit of a struggle. And they wanted you to have things like flow meters for tax meter, and if you went to big breweries, you'd see these big tax meters that were certified and all that. You know, we couldn't afford the tax meter; cost more than the whole brewery cost. So. We were able to convince them, as well as Jack, that you could have a metered tank with a graduated line and have an accurate enough volume. You actually pay taxes on the amount of bottled beers that leaves the door. So the government tank, as it was called, is sort of not necessarily necessary with the way they're taxing these days. So we got around that fairly early on. But it was tough in those days to deal with any government official. Anyone else? One back there. Almost none. The first, the bittering hops have changed a little bit because we started out with clusters. Some of these early recipes, we were 100% Cascade, but we really didn't start brewing that way. We started with cluster. And I mean, 80% of the U.S. hop crop used to be cluster, and today almost none of it's cluster. So we've switched bittering hops, but all the rest of the aroma hops, the original gravity, the BUs, all that stayed the same from day one. We haven't changed. One more. Where do I see craft beer, Sierra Nevada, or craft beer in general? Well, we're hoping we'll grow to 10% of the market share. We're about 5 right now, so you know our goal is to sort of double, and we think it's possible. If you look at the wine segment, the high end wine segment is much much higher than the high end beer segment currently. Although you know, with this economy, that's changing a little bit, but we think we've still got room to grow, Our segment has been doing very well considering the economy and the downturn. We're still growing as a segment, and the imports are down, and the domestics are pretty flat or down. So, you know, we feel we've got a good future, and as long as we all figure out how to keep making great beer, and we'll grow it all together. I want to thank all of you. It's been fun, and hopefully I'll get to see you around. So, thank you.
Well, thanks again to the AHA and to Ken Grossman for letting me record Ken's speech. It's awesome. It's always great to hear from, you know, the pioneers in brewing and home brewing. But inspiring stuff for those of us who may want to get into the business. You know, Ken's one of the ones who has paved the way for all the great craft beer in this country. And still... excellent craft beer coming from Sierra Nevada, so keep it up, Ken. Lots more stuff from coming up in the next few weeks from Oakland, remember, both in the audio and video side, so stay tuned. Remember, we've got the Brewer's Logbook and our Basic Winemaking Introduction to Wine Kits DVD out there on our online store. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say hey, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our other DVDs on our site as well, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, and Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. And we've got combo deals on our site to save you a couple of bucks. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We got shirts, which I saw some of those out there in Oakland, which was very cool. Those shirts have been to my house. That's where they start. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are chicken coops, 45 building plans for housing your flock, and Kitchens of India, ready-to-eat pindi chana, chickpea curry, 10-ounce boxes, pack of six. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support. And don't forget that you can also join the American Homebrewers Association through an associate link on basicbrewing.com now. And again, along with supporting the AHA, you'll be supporting our efforts as well. And you can get a free issue of Brew Your Own magazine when you click on the link there. And thanks for your support through that as well when you subscribe. Boy, that's a tortured sentence. That's all until next week. Till then, thanks for listening. Glad to be back. Thanks for being patient while we were gone. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.